Chapter 9, verse 18. Let's read together. The Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and 14th, and then on the 15th they rested and made it a day of feasting and joy. That is why rural Jews, those living in villages, observed the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day for giving presents to each other. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as a time when Jews got relief from their enemies, and as a month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. Turn our hearts to the message. Day of victory.
We come back to the book of Esther. We come back to a date that already familiar to us, the 13th day of the 12th month. We first came across this day back in chapter 3. It was a day that was set by the edict of Xerxes to be the date of extermination of the Jews throughout the entire Persian Empire. And now we come to chapter 9. The day actually arrived. And we see it in the first verse of chapter 9. And we find it to be a totally opposite event. Instead of a date when the entire race was exterminated, it was a date of victory. It was a date of celebration and salvation for all the Jews. Instead of being slaughtered by their enemies, it was a day when the enemies of the Jews were slaughtered and vanquished. We find it in verse 1. Look back in verse 1. We did not read that. I'll read it to you. Chapter 9, verse 1 tells us that on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. Now, this edict mentioned in verse 1 was not the original edict in chapter 3. This was the second edict. And the result of this second edict is this. Read on in verse 1. On that day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. But now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. What happened? What happened on that fateful day, the 13th day of the 12th month? What actually took place? Instead of being led to the slaughter like meek and quiet lambs being led to the slaughterhouse, it was the Jews who attacked those seeking their destruction. Instead of being helpless and hopeless, when the day did come, no one could stand against the Jews. Instead of being hated, instead of being reviled, instead of being slandered, pushed around, instead of being picked on for being the scapegoat, instead of being forced to wear the Star of David, now the people of all other nationalities were afraid of the Jews. Verse 5 in chapter 9 tells us that the Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did what they pleased to those who hated them. Just in the city, the citadel of Susa, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. We read that in verse 6. And the next verse tells us that they killed the 10 sons of Haman. They also killed 300 more men the next day. Verse 15 tells us that. And now these 810 deaths took place in Susa alone. That's only one out of four capitals. Verse 16 tells us that in the provinces, the Jews assembled to protect themselves and get relief from the enemies. And in the provinces, they killed 75,000. And this happened on the 13th day of the 12th month. That's a Jewish uprising. Very much like the ghetto uprising in Warsaw in 1943. The only difference is that 71 years ago, when the Jews rose up in resistance against their German exterminators, the Jews were met with total defeat and failures back in 1943. Instead of survival, the Jews in Warsaw were all sent to Treblinka, and they all perished with very, very, very few survivors. But here in chapter 9 in the Persian Empire, the uprising of the Jews were a total success. Their enemies were vanquished. Their status and their safety were secure. So great a victory that if you reread it again in verse 18, it tells us that the Jews in Susa, however, had assembled on the 13th and on the 14th. And on the 15th, they rested and they made it a day of feasting and joy. You read in verse 19 again, and that is why rural Jews now living in the country, in villages, observe the 14th of the month of Adar as a day of joy and feasting, a day where they give presents to each other. It was a day of victory. Mordecai recorded these events, and Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far. And Mordecai made it a perpetual, a permanent day of festivity to have them celebrate annually the 14th and the 15th day of the month of Adar as a time when the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a celebration. What happened in those 12 months? From the first month when the edict to exterminate the Jews were given to the day when it actually came, how could there such be a reversal of fortune so drastic? You cannot get any more dramatic than this. Hollywood could not have written a more dramatic script. Whose hand was at work throughout all these events? You see, on the surface, we might think that it was just luck. On the surface, we might just think that it was chance. Even the name of the festivity suggests to us that it was pure luck and pure chance that such reversal of fortune should take place. See, Mordecai had declared that the Jews for all generations shall celebrate the 14th and the 15th day of Adar as a commemoration of their good fortune. And the Jews called this festivity Purim. Five times the word Purim, P-U-R-I-M, Purim, appear in chapter 9. We haven't read it, but in beginning in verse 26, 28, 29, 31, 32, numerous times the word Purim appears. Purim comes from the word pur, P-U-R. And it's simply you add I-M at the end of a Hebrew word to make it plural. The word pur simply means a dye. You know what a dye is? It's not something that you color your clothes with. A dye is one little thing that's got six surfaces, and it's got one hole, two holes, three holes, four, five, six holes that you throw in the game of chance. And usually there are two together. We call them dice. The word Purim simply means throwing the dice. The original date of the 13th day of the 12th month was a date that was chosen by a die, by pur. In other words, it was a throw of the dice. On the surface, it seems that the Jews were threatened simply by chance, by a throw of the dice. On the surface, it seems that the date of extermination was chosen also by chance, by a throw of the dice. And also on the surface, it seems that it was a throw of the dice that their fortune was reversed. Therefore, the whole story of Esther is a story of throwing the dice. Even the name of the festivity comes from the meaning throwing of the dice. But is that what God has to say to us through this precious, not very well-known book of Esther? Absolutely not. Just the opposite. The message of Esther is that there is no accidents, no chance, no randomness in all creation. God created all things. God preordained and predestined all events. and God knows the outcomes of all events, even the throwing of the dice. We might think that it's random, but no events in all creation is random. Even the throwing of the dice. The Bible tells us that God preordained the outcome of the dice. God knows the outcome of the dice. Proverbs 16, Acts chapter 1. And God has His perfect and good will and purpose in all events. That is God's message to us consistently throughout His book, throughout the Bible. We call it God's providence. Please don't confuse God's providence with God providing. God provided you with shelter. That's wonderful. That's God's providing. God provided you with clothing to keep you warm. That's God's greatness, goodness, providing. God fed you. That's God providing. But that's not what God's providence means. God's providence means that all events, God preordained, God predestined, all outcomes God knows. For God created all things, and God's hands is in all things, maintaining, sustaining, directing, and ordering. And now what else is God saying to us with the book of Esther? He said it's so easy for us to fall into the trap of fatalism. So easy for us to say, we abuse the truth of the Bible to excuse ourselves of our failure, of our own irresponsibility. It's so easy for us to say, well, if God has preordained everything, if God should preordain that I should get into a car accident going home after church, there's nothing I can do about it. God determined it already. So I'm just going to drive out of the church parking lot 60 miles an hour and I'm going to hit somebody. I'll just blame God for predetermining me to hit somebody. God has determined that I should survive a serious accident. And therefore, I'm going to drive 60 miles, 70 miles an hour down the highway without wearing a seatbelt. I mean, whether or not I wear a seatbelt or not makes no difference, because God already predestined me to survive. There's nothing I can do about it. That is the error and danger of fatalism. Fatalism means an impersonal power outside of my control determine everything in my life, and there's nothing I can do about it. That is not what God says to us through His Word. On the contrary, God's message to us through the Bible is that God, the personal God who has created me, who loves me, who knows me, who has planned out the best chart of course for my life, He has predetermined and decided all events. And yet, the choices I make in life are perfectly genuine and perfectly free. Now, how do we explain that dilemma? We cannot. It's a paradox. But that's what God said to us through the Scripture. God predetermines our failures and setbacks also. But the Bible never put the blame on God. It is we who fail. It is we who are irresponsible, who are culpable for our failures. How do we explain that? We cannot. It's a paradox. But that's what the Scripture says. And that is the message of the book of Esther. God has predetermined all events in this book, and God foreknows the outcomes of every event in this book and every event in our lives. And yet, it was Esther. It was Esther who was facing the choice of her life. Will she go to Xerxes as Mordecai requested? She didn't know the outcome. All she knew was that she was taking a terrible and great risk. She had to face terrible consequences if she go to Xerxes without being summoned. Now what will she do? That is the truth of God's word we all have to apply in our lives. God has mapped out my life and your life before I was even made in my mother's womb. All events in my life, past, present, and future, are predetermined by a personal God who created me, who made me, who loves me, who knows me, who has my best interest in his heart and his mind and his hand. And he, by his perfect sovereignty, has preordained all events and knows me. But I don't know much of my life yet to come. Now what will I do with all the unknowns that I must face in the future? And here is what this beauty queen by the name of Esther have to teach us and every one of us. God has preordained all our life, but yet she took personal responsibility. She used the power of one, and she made all the difference. Number two, God has preordained all our lives, but she waited before God for strength and for courage. Number three, God has preordained all events, but she still acted, trusting in God's hand and trusting in God's time. And finally, this passage we teach us, God has preordained the outcome of all events. Victories are sure and certain, but the battles that win the victories are still ours to fight. Let's go back to how Esther took personal responsibility and how she used the power of one and how she made a difference. You see, Mordecai had challenged her in chapter 4. Basically, Mordecai was telling her four things. In chapter 4, verse 14, Mordecai is saying to Esther, don't deceive yourself. Don't think that your privileged position is going to protect you. You are just as vulnerable as every other Jew in the Persian Empire. The second thing that Mordecai was saying to Esther was that your choice to risk your life to go to the king is genuine and perfectly free. No one will force you. Even God has preordained that you will go, but the choice is still a free choice of yours to make. But if you should decide not to go, God's will and God's purpose will not be defeated. God has already predetermined that the Jews shall be saved. So if you should decide not to go, God will carry out his will. God will carry out his purpose by another means, through another person. The third thing that Mordecai was telling Esther was this: if you should decide not to go to the king, you will bear the responsibility, and you cannot blame God for your failure. And the fourth thing Mordecai is saying to Esther is that God has predetermined all events, even before they should happen before your eyes. Why do you think Mordecai is saying to Esther, Vashti, remember Vashti, the queen that was deposed? Why do you think Vashti was deposed? Why do you think you should be born so attractive and so beautiful? Why do you think that I should adopt you as my daughter? Why do you think you should be chosen as Vashti's replacement? Why all these dramatic events? Because they were set up by God for such a time as this. And here's a question facing Esther and facing all of us in every day of our lives. If God has preordained all events, what does he need me for? If God had preordained that some person in Arizona, in the reservation, should be saved, what does he need me and you expending so much energy and effort to go down there for? If God had predetermined all events, why does he still ask me to help? God doesn't need my help. God doesn't need our going far, far away, driving such long distance to do what seems to be impossible. If God decided that some should be saved, he could have done the impossible without our help. This is what God's providence means. God is the sovereign God who has preordained, who has predetermined, foreknown all events. But God consistently invite us to be partners with him. God always invite us to co-work with him. That is how God worked in his creation. People always ask, I'm only one little person, what good can I do? I'm only one little person, how much good can I do? That's the kind of question that Satan would love to plant in your heart and in my heart, in your mind and in my mind. That is the kind of question that Satan would love to have you ask. What good can you do? You're only one person. How much good can you do? You're only one person. I'm sure Satan was hard at work in that palace of Xerxes. I'm sure Satan was saying to Esther, it's not your problem. You are safe. You are secure. No harm will come to you. I'm sure Satan was hard at work trying to convince Esther, why risk your life by going to Xerxes without his summons? It's not worth it. Just like Mordecai said, somebody else can do the job just as well as you can. Relax, sit tight, do nothing. It's not your job. Besides, you are a woman. What could you do? What could one little woman do to save a whole race? You're only power of one. What could you do? You are only power of one. What difference could you make? I'm sure Satan was hard at work in Esther's heart and mind. And I'm sure Satan, if he has not done so, he will be hard at work in your heart and in your mind with the same deception. You are only the power of one. What difference could you make? You see, Satan defeats us not by planting in our hearts and mind doubts about God. Satan defeats us by planting in our hearts and mind doubts about ourselves. What difference could you make? What difference could I make? Esther took personal responsibility, and she made all the differences. Verse 16 in chapter 4, I'll read to you. Esther said, I will go to the king even though it is against the law. If I perish, I perish. See, God knows the outcome of all events. But Esther didn't. She didn't know the consequences of her going to Xerxes without being summoned. You see, at this point, she didn't even know what to say to the king. At this point, she didn't even know the events of chapter 5, 6, and 7. She didn't know how to expose Haman's evil. At this point, remember, Haman was still Xerxes' favorite. How could Esther ask Xerxes to hang Haman? She didn't know what to do or say. How could Esther ask Xerxes to spare the Jews? At this point, Xerxes had not had his insomnia yet. I never told you about his insomnia. That is in chapter 5. I'll put it off until next week. Xerxes had not realized that he owed Mordecai his life. Esther did not know the when, Esther did not know the how, and Esther did not know the what. But she made the choice of her life, freely and genuinely. She said, I will go. If I perish, I perish. See, the heroism of Esther was not only in the fact that she risked her life to go to the king. Her heroism is seen in that not knowing all the hows and not knowing all the what. She took up the responsibility, she used her power of one, and she made a difference. Can one person make any difference? It was 1517. One person nailed a piece of document on a church door in Wittenberg in Germany. And on that piece of document we now call the 95 Theses. He challenged the corruption and he challenged the false teaching of the most powerful institution on earth. He challenged the Roman Catholic Church. That one person made all the difference in the world. There are so many other stories and illustrations I can tell you that one person can make all the difference in the world. Because at the time, I will only tell you one. It wasn't too long ago. It was in your lifetime. You will remember. It was only 14 years ago. It was the year 2000. The future of this country and the future of the world was hanging on the decision of one person. You remember 14 years ago in 2000? It was election time. It was Bush versus Gore. And it all came down to the result of Florida. The race was so tight. In Florida, it was so tight. Out of 6 million votes casted, Bush was leading by a number of 537. At stake was 25 electoral votes in Florida. There were all kinds of voting irregularities, and the validity of many ballots were questioned. So there was a recount. You all remember? Will Bush Lee disappear because of the recount? And if the recount should be allowed, how long would it take? And what assurance that the recount will be definitive? So the dispute was brought before the Supreme Court. And by decision of 5-4, the Supreme Court decision came down, stopped the recount. You remember that? One person made a difference, declaring Bush the winner in Florida and giving 25 electoral votes to Bush. And because of Florida's 25 electoral votes, Bush had a total of 271 electoral votes. And how many electoral votes does he need to become the President of the United States in 2000? 270. One person made all the differences. Satan would love to tell every Christian, you don't count. Satan would love to tell you, you cannot make any difference because you don't know how, because you don't know what. You don't have what it takes. Besides, somebody else can do the job better than you can. God doesn't need you because God has everything predetermined already. And there's nothing you can do that could make a difference. It's not your job anyway. It's somebody else's job. That is what Satan loves to tell you. And when you believe it, the kingdom of God is so much weakened. And when you believe that lie of Satan, the church of Christ is so much weakened. Don't believe it. It's a lie Satan loves to deceive you with. The Christian who truly understands the truth about God's providence, the Christian who truly believes in God's sovereign power, is the one who responds to God by saying, I can make a difference. And I want to make a difference. If you are young and you don't think you can make a difference, if you are young and you don't want to make a difference, let me ask you, what are you living for? You have such long life ahead of you. And if you're old and you don't know you can make a difference or you don't want to make a difference, what are you waiting for? The truth of God's providence always motivates us to take up our responsibility than to use our power of one and to make a difference. See, the health of our church depends on how well you understand God's providence and how much you believe in God's sovereignty. When God is sovereign, then I'm going to stand up and say, God, I'm going to partner with you because I cannot fail, because God cannot fail. Esther did that. She also did another thing. She waited on God. Motivational seminars are great, aren't they? I'm sure many of us have gone to motivational seminars. If you haven't, that's because you haven't been in the workplace yet. You see, when you've been in the workplace long enough, your boss senses that you are tired and you need a kick in the you-know-where. So your boss wants to make you more productive, right? So he sends you company money paying you to go to some motivational seminars and listen to some motivational speakers, to get you challenged, to get you fired up, to get you going, to get you more productive. But how far can you really go? Those who are motivated, they come back to the desk and they really got fired up for 1 week. And then the fire motivation died down just as fast. You see, what Esther needed was not another motivational seminar. What Esther needed was time in the presence of God. What Esther needed was strength from God that could carry her through her ordeal. What she needed was not motivational seminar, but real courage from God that would allow her to manage her fear. And that is what Esther did before anything. She already made up her choice to go to Xerxes. The decision to go was made. But the action will not be taken before she has spent time she needed before God. In chapter 4, verse 15, Esther sent his reply to Mordecai. Esther said, go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. And do not eat and drink for 3 days, night or day. And I and my maid will do the same thing. We will fast as you do. And when this is done, then I will go to the king. You see, we have mentioned already that the book of Esther is unique among 66 books of the Bible. Esther is the only book that God is never mentioned. Esther is the only book that prayer is not mentioned. Worship is not mentioned. It is as if God has nothing to do with anything in this book. That, of course, was only a superficial understanding of the book of Esther. God is not mentioned not because he is absent. God was not mentioned because of the point of the truth that in all human events, when God seems so silent, when God seems so distant and absent, he is always in the back of the stage. God is always behind the curtain, directing and maintaining and determining all that is going on the stage. Prayers are not mentioned in this fasting. But what do you think they were doing during those 3 days of fasting? Do you think they fasted for 3 days and night because they want to lose some weight? I don't think so. They fasted because they wanted to be even more sensitive to what God had to say to them. They fasted for so long because they wanted to be heightened in their resolve, that they may be growing weaker and weaker in their physical strength. But the task that lies ahead cannot be accomplished by human strength or power. They fasted for so long because they needed to be heightened in their resolve and awareness. Only by God's hand can the fortune of the Jews be reversed. They fasted for so long because they were saying to God, only you can do it. We don't know how, we don't know what you're going to do, we don't know how you're going to do it, but we will obey and we will take up our responsibility, but we need you to do the impossible. This is a good preparation for our mission trip again. That is what God's providence applied in our lives mean. We will take up our responsibility. We will make the choice to make a difference in this world. But it is you, God. It is you alone that can accomplish the impossible. And after Esther's choice to go to Xerxes, after her prayer and after her fasting, she went and she cooperated with God's preordination and God's predestination. She acted at the same time as God acted. And chapter 5 will tell us what she did. Now, what would you do if you were Esther? You go to the king. Would you impulsively, right away, point your finger at Haman and declare him the greatest danger against your people? Would you tell the king to hang him so quickly? Why not? There's great urgency for Esther to do that. Esther didn't do that. She took her time. She didn't just sit there and did nothing. She went to Xerxes. And the text tells us that instead of being deposed, incurring the wrath of Xerxes for violating Persian laws, Xerxes treated her with great favor. Xerxes was so pleased to see her that he promised Esther whatever she requests, he will give her, even up to half of the kingdom. Now, what a great opportunity. When Xerxes said to you, I like you, whatever you want, I'll give it to you. Now, wouldn't that be the right time to say, get that guy Haman? But she did. All she did was she invited Xerxes and Haman to her banquet. And they did. They came. And when they came, Esther still didn't do anything. Xerxes again promised Esther, okay, during the first banquet, whatever request you make, I'll give it to you, even up to half of your kingdom. Esther again said nothing, only to invite Xerxes and Haman back the next day for a second banquet. What was Esther doing? I mean, did she purposely plan it that way? Was she playing with Xerxes? I don't think so. There's no indication anywhere in this book that God had revealed any of his plan to Esther. I believe Esther did not tell Xerxes what she wanted because Esther could not. Esther could not tell what she wanted because she did not know what was going to happen, because she did not know how to bring up the matter. How could she know? Out of nowhere, to tell Cersei, his favorite official, to kill him. Esther did not know what to do or what to say. But all through that fateful week, she knew somehow God has his hand in all the events. All she knew was that she needed to trust in God's hand, and she needed to trust in God's time. Esther knew she needed to go to Cersei right away. The 13th day of Adar is just around the corner. Her going to Cersei could not be delayed. But how is God going to act? She didn't know. When is God going to act? She didn't know. Waiting on God does not mean that we wait passively and do nothing. God will bring salvation to many through this church. But waiting on God's salvation to come to many does not mean that we sit around passively and do nothing. We still go out. We still seek the lost. We still proclaim the gospel. And we still extend the invitation to Christ. We wait actively, just as Esther waited for God's salvation actively. And finally, the truth of God's providence means victories in our lives are sure and certain. But battles that win the victories are still ours to fight. How did Esther tell Cersei about Haman? How did Haman come to meet his end? I'll save it for next week. I'll have one more Sunday on the book of Esther. But for the remaining time, not much, I would like to draw attention to how did the Jews come to the victories and celebration. Well, of course, through Esther. But how did she do it? In chapter 8, verse 5, Esther had made a request, finally. Right? Esther said, "If it pleases the king," she said, "and if he regards me with favor and thinks it right thing to do, and if he is pleased with me, let an order be written overruling the dispatches that Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, devised and wrote to destroy the Jews in all the king's provinces." Esther was asking Cersei to revoke the first edict. Now, could Cersei do that? No, he couldn't. Cersei could not reverse himself, even though he was the king. And because in ancient culture, when a king, when an emperor declares something, begin edict something, it cannot be reversed. And that is what the end of verse 8 in chapter 8 tells us. But no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked. Now, if he could not revoke the order to exterminate the Jews, how could the Jews be saved? This is what godly wisdom means. God has his way to override Cersei's. God has his way to protect his people. God has his way to bring about his purpose. Cersei now asks Esther and Mordecai to draft a second edict. And it was Mordecai who demonstrated God's wisdom. They could not revoke the first edict. But what they wrote was this. The second edict granted the Jews legal and royal sanction to defend themselves. Chapter 8, verse 11. The king edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate any armed forces of any nationalities or provinces that attack them and their women and their children, and to plunder the properties of enemies. And that the Jews did on the 13th day of the 12th month. They fought the enemies. They slaughtered 810 men in Susa and 75,000 in the provinces. Do you think those 810 people die quietly? Do you think the 10 sons of Haman die meekly? I don't think so. I'm sure they put up a great fight. After all, the first edict was still in effect. After all, they still had the king's sanction to wipe out the Jews. After all, the 10 sons of Haman have vengeance in their heart. We can be sure that those 75,810 men did not die quietly, did not die meekly. The battles were won, but the ferocity was not mentioned. Victories in our lives are God's ordained, but they are still battles that we have to fight. Not only did the Jews gain victories over the enemies, They established their reputation as a race that should be feared, as a race that cannot be molested. God's sovereignty and God's providence has predetermined every event in our lives. He foreknows every outcome of our lives. And yet the choices that we make are free choices and real choices. If we make foolish choices and disobey God, we cannot blame God. The culpability is ours to bear. God's providence means God determines all events, and it is I who has to be faithful to my responsibility. Never underestimate the power of one. Satan would love to deceive us with a lie that we cannot make any difference. Satan would love to deceive us with a lie that we don't want to make any difference. When we are motivated to act, come before God first, to seek His presence, to seek His strength, to seek His power and courage. When we act, act trusting in God's hand, act trusting in God's time. And battles are still ours to fight in life. We give thanks because what the Bible tells us, so impossible to explain, so impossible to use our own rationale to believe. How could God's sovereignty preordain all things, and yet my choices I make are still free? I thank God and I praise God for all events are caused by Him, preordained by Him, and all outcomes are known by Him. I thank God for that. Let's all stand together as we respond with a song, a hymn, an old hymn.